This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed gave Tigrayan forces 72 hours to surrender before the military begins an offensive on the regional capital of Mekele. Abiy said on Twitter Sunday that the rebels are at the point of no return and should give in. Tigrayan forces could not immediately be reached for comment. A military spokesman said earlier that advancing Ethiopian troops plan to surround the capital city with tanks and may shell it, and civilians were told to leave while they still can. The Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, which is refusing to surrender its rule of the northern region, said its forces were digging trenches and standing firm. We should note that claims by all sides are hard to verify because phone and internet communication has been down. The conflict erupted on November 4th and has killed hundreds, possibly thousands, and has sent more than 30,000 refugees into neighboring Sudan. And rockets have been fired by rebels across the border into the nation of Eritrea. Foreign nations have urged talks, but Abe has pressed on with the offensive. And Iran on Sunday vowed to defeat any Israeli attempt to harm its role in Syria, saying the era of hit-and-run attacks by Israel there was over, days after Israel carried out airstrikes on Syrian army and Iranian paramilitary targets in the country. Israel, which views Tehran as its biggest security threat, has repeatedly attacked Iranian targets and those of allied militia in Syria, where Tehran has backed President Bashar al-Assad and his forces against rebels and militants since 2012. Palestinian militants, meanwhile, fired a rocket into Israel, drawing Israeli airstrikes in the Gaza Strip. The Israeli military reported this on Sunday. There were no casualties reported from either side. This is VOA News. The first Americans could receive a COVID-19 vaccine as soon as December 11th, the chief scientific advisor for the U.S. government's vaccine program said on Sunday. Moncef Slaoui told NBC's Meet the Press news show that within 24 hours from approval, the vaccine will be moving to where it's needed most. He said about 70% of the population needs to be immunized to achieve herd immunity, a goal the country could reach by May. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration's outside advisors will meet on December 10th to discuss whether to authorize the COVID-19 vaccine developed by Pfizer Incorporated and German partner BioNTech for emergency use. Spain will begin a comprehensive coronavirus vaccination program in January, Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez said on Sunday. He said Spain and Germany were the first European Union countries to have a complete vaccination plan in place. Australia's top military official said on Sunday the country's defense force must own a recent report on soldiers committing crimes in Afghanistan and pledged changes to ensure that atrocities do not happen again. The report was published on Thursday after an inquiry into the conduct of special forces personnel in Afghanistan between 2005 and 2016. It found that senior commandos forced junior soldiers to kill defenseless captives in order to prepare them for combat in an act called blooding. A newly elected MP for Myanmar's ruling party has been shot dead by an unidentified gunman in northern Shan State, and the party on Sunday urged a quick investigation. It also denounced political violence in the aftermath of elections this month. Thousands of people took to Taipei streets on Sunday for the annual Autumn Struggle Protest March, organized by labor groups, with much of the anger focused on the government's decision to ease restrictions on imports of U.S. pork. Taiwan's main opposition party, the Kuomintang, or KMT, rallied its supporters to join the march for the first time, having mounted an increasingly strident campaign against the pork decision, which it says threatens food safety. Afghanistan faces funding cuts and tighter restrictions on vital aid from an international donor conference this week hosted in Geneva, marking further challenges for a nation torn by two decades of war and now ravaged by COVID-19. Ministers from about 70 countries and officials of humanitarian organizations will meet virtually early next week. They're expected to pledge billions of dollars to safeguard development projects, with talks between the Afghan government and Taliban rebels stalled and President Trump reducing forces. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, is Ethiopia on the brink of civil war? What's behind the outbreak of violence between the Ethiopian central government and the leadership in the northern Tigray region? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. On November 4, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, a recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize in 2019 for resolving the border conflict with neighboring Eritrea, launched a military offensive in Tigray after accusing its ruling party, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, of attacking a federal army base. According to Agence France-Presse, hundreds of people have been killed so far in the conflict in Ethiopia, Africa's second most populous country. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, warns that a full-scale humanitarian crisis is unfolding as thousands of refugees flee the fighting in Ethiopia's Tigray region to seek safety in eastern Sudan. Thus far, more than 30,000 Ethiopians have fled into Sudan. In addition, aid agencies say they are struggling to reach thousands of Eritrean refugees living in Tigray. Until Abiy Ahmed came to power in 2018, the Tigray People's Liberation Front were part of Ethiopia's ruling coalition. However, according to a Sufan Center intel brief on the conflict, one of the reasons why the TPLF did not want to join Abiy Ahmed's New Prosperity Party coalition is because he was willing to concede the town of Badme to Eritrea. This territorial concession led to the end of a more than 20-year-long border standoff between Ethiopia and Eritrea and earned Abiy Ahmed the Nobel Peace Prize. The Sufan Center says that some international organizations are urging Abiy Ahmed to engage in peace talks with the TPLF, but for now, it appears that the Ethiopian military is looking for a decisive victory. Sudan and Eritrea are cooperating with the Ethiopian military, while the TPLF does not appear to have substantive foreign backing. In a dangerous escalation of the violence, the Tigray People's Liberation Front attacked the airport in Asmara, the capital of Eritrea, on November 14th. The U.S. Department of State issued a strong condemnation of this attack and expressed its concern that the TPLF is causing unnecessary regional instability. The State Department is, quote, urging both the TPLF and the Ethiopian authorities to take immediate steps to de-escalate the conflict, restore peace, and protect civilians, unquote. Well, for more on the political and humanitarian crisis in Ethiopia and threats to the region, we turn to two distinguished analysts. Ambassador David Shin is former ambassador to Ethiopia and Burkina Faso, currently professor of international affairs at the George Washington University's School of International Affairs, and Susan Stigand. She's director of Africa programs at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Susan also serves as co-chair of USIP's National Dialogue Working Group. Prior to joining USIP, she managed constitutional development, citizen engagement, and election observation programs at the National Democratic Institute. And both panelists joined me via Microsoft Teams to stem the spread of the coronavirus. Ambassador Shin, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Carol.
And Susan, we're very happy to have you as well, Susan Stigand.
Thanks for having me on, Carol.
So let me first go to you, Ambassador Shin. How concerned are you about this outbreak of violence? And what do you believe are the primary underlying factors, you know, the tensions between the federal government in Addis and the Tigray region that possibly led to this outbreak of violence?
I'm deeply troubled by what has occurred in the last several weeks, particularly, although the antecedents of it go back probably three decades. I think that it has the possibility of literally a breakup of Ethiopia if this is not handled very delicately. In the first instance, I think the problem goes back to an issue that you alluded to, and that is the fact that you had the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, known as the EPRDF, which was in control of the country starting in 1991, but the principal partner in the EPRDF was the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, or the TPLF, which had considerable control of government throughout most of the last three decades. That changed when Abiy Ahmed came to power in 2018. You saw a retreat, sort of, by Tigrayans back to Tigray region, which borders Eritrea, borders Amhara region, borders Sudan, There was apparently a desire to establish a firm control by the TPLF in Tigray region. We saw that with the local elections that took place there that ran in spite of an edict out of Addis Ababa that all elections be postponed. That exacerbated the relationship between Tigray region and Addis Ababa. One thing led to another, and you had in recent weeks this outbreak of real conflict between Tigray and effectively the rest of Ethiopia. Unfortunately, that is only part of the problem, and it's the only problem that's being focused on at the moment. There still are all of the ethnic issues that were very serious in Ethiopia prior to this conflict between Tigray and the government in Addis Ababa.
Over to you, Susan Stigant. Are you equally concerned, as is Ambassador Shin, that the current crisis could even lead to a breakup of Ethiopia, that these tensions are so long-standing and even precede the most recent ones he alluded to, whether it's the change of government in 2018, as well as, you know, the fact that the region of Tigray held elections in defiance of the federal government because of the COVID crisis? What's your take?
I don't think we can overestimate at this stage the risks of this conflict, the violence and the consequences, the terrible humanitarian and security consequences that it could have both for Ethiopia's security and future and peace, and all of the hopes that I think people had as the country went into this transition, and also the potential risks and what we see already as the regionalization of this conflict with the refugees spilling into Sudan's eastern region. At the same time, I think it's not inevitable that we're in a stage of protracted violence between the federal government and the Tigray region. But changing path will fundamentally require a different approach, taking a different approach of responsibility by both of these parties. As I think about where did this conflict come from and what underlies it, in addition to some of the particular events that you and Ambassador Shin outlined, when the transition place for Ethiopia, there was never a moment where there was agreement on a new political settlement for the country. There were negotiations and new structures that were put in place. Prime Minister Abiy founded the Prosperity Party, but there was not a fundamental agreement about how the country would go forward to elections and what the structures would look like given the massive social, political, and economic changes that were underway. And I think this is what the country will really need to grapple with. But first, the immediate priority is really to de-escalate the violence and to get the country back from the brink that it's really facing at this moment.
Back to you, Ambassador Shin. In terms of Tigray, what do you think the TPLF wants? I mean, they are well-armed and experienced fighters. And to what extent are the people of Tigray behind them? Do they have popular support?
Sure. I can only speculate as to what the Tigray authorities want and also the degree of support they have from the Tigrayan people. My impression is that the Tigrayan authorities, the TPLF, are looking for a greater degree of regional autonomy. Hence, they went forward with elections, even though the government in Addis Ababa was opposed to that. I don't believe, as some in Ethiopia allege, that the TPLF is trying to reassert authority over the entire country. And that is one of my real concerns now, that there is, a growing feeling in some quarters in Ethiopia and in the diaspora that you must absolutely crush the TPLF before there can be any solution to the problem. I think that would simply exacerbate the problem if there were an effort to do that. As far as the support for the TPLF, as we saw during the recent regional elections in October, the TPLF won overwhelmingly. There were not international observers for that election, so we don't know whether there were any problems with it. And I am a little surprised, quite frankly, that the government military forces have been able to enter Tigray region and take the towns of Shire and Aksum. I would not have thought it would have been that easy to do that. But whether that is simply a short-term victory by the federal government forces and there are much more difficult things to come or not remains to be seen.
Susan Stigant, what's your take on what the TPLF want at the end of the day, and how would you assess the federal government's intervention and the fact that it seems, at least from the rhetoric we're hearing, that they would like to just crush this uprising? And is that even possible or desirable in the long run?
I'm really concerned by the characterization of this rule of law operation and the idea that a military operation can address what at the core will be fundamentally political challenges and political problems. I think Prime Minister Abbey has accused the TPLF of undermining the transition, of fomenting violence and opposition throughout the country, and really being the obstacle towards the reforms that he envisions. My view is, even if that were true, even if we take at face value the allegations that the TPLF attacked the Northern Command, then any sort of response has to be proportionate. We know from history in Ethiopia's own terrible violence that the country has lived through, and that I think every family and individual has been affected and knows the stories all too well, that violence rarely, if ever, works in the long term. And so I think what's fundamentally needed is, how do we get the parties to step back and think about a different way of approaching this? Because I think there's a real risk that it continues to devolve into some sort of protracted conflict, and whether that's medium intensity conflict or just ongoing low level intensity conflict.
Well, we'll have more on that in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Joining me via Microsoft Teams are Ambassador David Chin, former ambassador to Ethiopia and Burkina Faso, and Susan Stigand, from whom you just heard. She's director of Africa programs at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And we're discussing the outbreak of deadly violence in the Tigray region of Ethiopia and its regional ramifications. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal Encounter listener and Facebook fan, Orot Moses from Juba, South Sudan. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our discussion, and over to you, Ambassador Chin, about trying to diffuse this horrible crisis, which has displaced so many Ethiopians, Eritreans, who had sought refuge in Tigray. They're going to Eastern Sudan. It's very difficult for Sudan in particular, because it is trying to chart a path toward democracy after so many years of authoritarian rule. Do you see any type of mediation, the international community?
I think there's the possibility that some outside organizations would be willing to mediate the current situation. I'm not sure I see that much willingness in South Ethiopia to accept mediation from the outside. I wanted to echo a point that Susan made, and that is, at the moment, everyone seems to be totally focused on the conflict between the central government military forces and the TPLF forces, almost seemingly making the assumption that if that could be resolved, that Ethiopia's problems would be over. I don't see it that way at all. I think, as Susan suggests, there's a much broader need for a nationwide political settlement, discussion, and dialogue at the national level. You will still have differences among the Oromo, the most populous ethnic group in Ethiopia. There will still be problems in Beni Shangal, in Somali region, conceivably in Afar region, and in southwestern Ethiopia. All of these need to be looked at and discussed in a collaborative way, and simply bringing the current military conflict to an end is not going to end the overall problem. Even if it were possible to bring the current conflict in Tigray to an end militarily, and I think that is highly doubtful.
That's an excellent point that you bring up, Ambassador Chin. So back to you, Susan Stigand, about this need for a national dialogue, and to what extent it's even possible under Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who has postponed elections. As Ambassador Chin said, there are so many, and you have as well, there are many other ethnic tensions swept under the rug, whether Oromo, Somali region, Afar. First of all, do you think that Abiy Ahmed and his party recognize the need for that? And if they do they even have the political will to initiate a national dialogue?
Well, there have been some initiatives already launched towards a national dialogue in partnership with the government. I think that those are encouraging to some extent. However, it's not sufficiently inclusive of the key political groups who need part of that conversation. And with this escalation in violence in Tigray, and what we've seen is really a closing of political space, an increase in the number of prisoners, an increase in the violence and intercommunal and interethnic violence, creating a safe space for people to have a genuine dialogue is increasingly difficult. And so I think it's the right time to plan towards what that dialogue would need to look like. However, getting to a place where some confidence can be built that that would be a meaningful, trusted space and could make a difference, that will require ending the current violence in Tigray. It will likely require some sort of release of some of the prisoners who are seen by many to be arrested on more political reasons than criminal reasons. And obviously, these are all incredibly complex questions, and leading a transition such as the one that Ethiopia is going through is tremendously difficult and really carries a great deal of responsibility. And I think it's really in Prime Minister Abiy's hands to figure out where does he want his legacy. And for the region and the continent and the best advisors of those who have led towards more peaceful societies and navigated these types of conflicts, to be his good advisors and to offer their help and to make clear that this is really an issue of peace and security, not just a domestic challenge within Ethiopia's own borders.
Over to you, Ambassador Shin. We talked about Abiy Ahmed, you know, having received the Nobel Peace Prize for resolving the border conflict between Ethiopia and Eritrea. What do you know of his inclinations at this point? He has been cracking down, closing political space, vowing to, you know, bring those he feels have caused this violence, bring to justice perhaps members of the TPLF. I mean, that may not be a very constructive path toward reconciliation. How much blame should he bear for what is going on?
Well, I think blame for what is happening in Ethiopia today is pretty widespread. I would not single anyone out for being predominantly behind or the cause of what is happening in the country today. I think that if Prime Minister Abiy is thinking that somehow crushing the TPLF is going to solve his internal problems in the country, frankly, I think that's wrong. I don't think it will. There is indeed a great deal of animosity that has built up over the last three decades towards the Tigrayans. It may be possible at the moment to more or less unify the country against the Tigrayans, but these other ethnic issues are going to come back no matter what happens in Tigray region. And if Abiy is not taking that into account, I think he's really missing out on the opportunity of keeping and retaining a unified Ethiopia, which from my very parochial perspective, is what is required here. I think the breakup of the country would be the worst possible outcome. And I think it's critical that all the parties do what they can to ensure the unity of the country.
Back to you, Susan Stigand. You mentioned Abiy Ahmed and his legacy. How do you see his options? And from what you know of him, having received the Nobel Peace Prize, but yet having this other reputation of cracking down and closing political space, as you said, and now this so-called law and order initiative in Tigray, which has really escalated the conflict and spilled over into the region in Sudan and Eritrea. Does the fact that he postponed elections, notwithstanding the COVID pandemic, which is certainly a valid reason, but when will they be rescheduled? Is that a factor? How do you see it?
Yeah, Carol, you asked the question about where does blame sit? And I think that that's a really important question and a very risky question to ask at this point. And what I worry about is all of the blame that's going back and forth right now within the country and blaming others. And there's allegations of killing of senior military officers from the Amhara region. There are allegations and reports of citizens from Tigray who are being profiled based on their ethnicity and removed from positions, blocked from travel, bank accounts blocked. There's pretty strong documentation about humanitarian access being blocked. And I think this feeds into what is really a spiraling set of narratives of other. And we know that in other circumstances, that really puts the country at risk for further violence and makes it harder for any sort of dialogue or reconciliation to take place at some stage. So I think one thing that Prime Minister Abiy and the TPLF could really jointly call for is some sort of independent external investigation about what is taking place. to allow people to take the lid off of this boiling pot and allow for some of that rhetoric to slow down a bit and to take that out of the equation in this moment.
Back to you, Ambassador Shin, to just briefly touch on the role of Eritrea and Sudan. Are they backing the federal government of Ethiopia in this current conflict? What are their roles?
In the case of Sudan, as far as I can tell, the only role they have played so far is to receive refugees coming out of Ethiopia, mainly out of Tigray region. And I'm not aware that they have taken any other action, either supportive of the central government in Addis Ababa or the government in Tigray region. The situation in Eritrea is far more complex, and you have allegations coming from both Tigray region and from Eritrea that are somewhat conflicting. The Tigrayan authorities did acknowledge that they sent a couple of rockets into the airport in Asmara, but they claim they did it because there were attacks that were coming from the Eritrean side. Clearly, Eritrea has involved itself to some extent. The degree is just not known at this point.
Susan Stigant, your take on the role of Eritrea, to what extent it exacerbates the conflict, and also how dangerous this is for Sudan, receiving so many refugees. It's already a fragile state trying to create a democratic path forward.
Yeah, as Ambassador Shin said, the TPLF has indicated that they sent missiles over towards the Eritrean capital. I think that was done on the allegation that the Ethiopian Defense Forces were operating from Eritrea. I think these are some of the other allegations that probably need to be better investigated and understood. There's still pretty limited access and insight on what's happening in Eritrea, pretty limited channels of communication with President Isaias. And I think that this is really important. You know, we've been looking and talking about the critical interconnection between the Gulf countries, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the Horn of Africa, and how this is really increasingly an interconnected political, economic, and security space. We've just put out a report that really calls on the U.S. government to develop a new diplomatic and political engagement strategy that understands and really sets priorities around these new realities in the greater Red Sea region. And we saw this play out in the case of the Sudan transition, I think, where there was an ability to work closely together with the Emiratis and the Saudis and the US and the UK and other partners to create space for the mediation process that the African Union and Ethiopia indeed helped to lead as the Sudanese negotiated their power-sharing arrangements between the security and civilian elements. And I think we need to see that type of effort continue in the case of Ethiopia, and to make sure that the right safeguards are in place to keep that Sudanese transition on track.
As we close, Ambassador Shin, any final words, especially with respect to the U.S. role? President-elect Biden will have a lot on his plate, but do you foresee perhaps more constructive involvement, similar to what Susan Stigant mentioned?
I do think that looking forward, the Biden administration will take a deep and serious interest in what is happening, not only in Ethiopia, but in the Horn of Africa generally. I think it fully understands the importance of the region, the interconnectivity of the various conflicts that are going on there, and with Al-Shabaab and Somalia, with ongoing issues in South Sudan, an effort to create a democratic government in Sudan. So I'm hopeful that there will be more attention given to the region with the Biden administration. But we, of course, still have to get through the next 2 months. And I am a bit concerned that as one administration is leaving, its focus is probably elsewhere. And even with the new Biden administration coming in, it's not going to be able to focus in its first week on what's happening in the Horn of Africa. It's going to take a little time to get people in place and focus on the region. But I think eventually it will.
That's all the time we have, unfortunately, on this edition of the program. But we shall continue this important conversation about Ethiopia and the Horn of Africa in general. I'd like to thank my guests, Ambassador David Shin, former ambassador to Ethiopia and Burkina Faso, and Susan Stigant, Director of Africa Programs at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. Dr. Jill Robbins brings us the education report. Today she talks about teaching peace in the classroom. I will return with another words and their stories. This week I teach idioms from the Thanksgiving dinner table. And we end our 30 minutes together with The Making of a Nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. But first, here is Dr. Jill Robbins.
Peace education is a growing area of research at some colleges and universities. Peace education programs often explore subjects covered in the news, such as violence in schools and mental health issues during a quarantine. In Japan this week, Rebecca Oxford was to speak at a meeting of JALT, the Japan Association for Language Teaching. Her subject, the language of peace. Oxford is Professor Emeritus at the University of Maryland in the United States. She says that foreign and second language teacher educators and their students have an important duty to play in fostering peace. She adds, peace is created through communication, and that communication is the main goal of language teacher educators and teachers. Oxford says there are six parts to peace. They are inner peace, interpersonal peace, intergroup peace, intercultural peace, international peace, and ecological peace, or care for the environment. She believes these six terms give teachers a common basis on which to talk about conflict and work for peace. Part of Oxford's approach to the language of peace is to change signs of conflict into respect for the values and hopes of the people involved. She says peace builders should look for the causes of conflict and use this information to reduce violence between people, groups, and cultures. Not everyone agrees on the value of peace education programs. Heather Millstone is with the University of Queensland in Australia. She did research on how peace programs work in Australian schools. Millstone identified three criticisms of the programs. One is the lack of evidence that they work. Another is how peace programs pay attention to a child's relationship with other children instead of on the larger community. Millstone says this puts a responsibility on children to create peace when the society around them is violent. The third criticism is that the programs do not consider cultural values, such as whether an individual or a group is more important in society. One United States-based group has been using criticisms like these to shape its peace education programs. Tim Nation is Executive Director of the Peace Learning Center, or PLC, in Indianapolis, Indiana. He says the PLC began in the 1990s as part of AmeriCorps, a service program similar to the U.S. government's Peace Corps. He told VOA it began working with children who experienced violence at home and then moved to programs to reduce violence in schools.
We saw going through workshops on conflict resolution and then sharing with the kids that this is one of the missing links in our society. We realized that if you could teach young people at an early age, then you could have a larger impact and help kids succeed.
Over the past year, the PLC joined with the tribe's learning community, a social and emotional learning program. Tribes offers training for elementary, middle, and high school teachers, as well as for those working in after-school and youth development programs. Nation says the work of tribes is based on evidence from research into how to build communities in schools and classrooms.
It's helped us with an evidence-based system that is easy to use for teachers and lessons that are easy to use, and proven to reduce conflicts and increase academic progress while helping each student learn skills that they can use for a lifetime.
The tribe's learning community has over 5,000 trainers worldwide, with programs in Canada, Australia, and other English-speaking countries. It also offers Spanish language educational materials. Nation notes that with the change to online learning, help with understanding social and emotional learning is what teachers need right now.
And learning social emotional learning skills is really important because that's what you're asked to do in the workforce. When we lose out on our ability to communicate and collaborate, that's not good for the future of our workforce and our society.
HEART is an aid group that promotes humane education. That is, it is a charity promoting social and emotional learning, or SEL. In a recent education story, we reported on the importance of SEL at some schools. PLC, Tribes, and HEART came together to develop tools for teachers to use in classrooms. Everyday circle cards are one example of a short activity teachers can add to each class. It helps students learn the social skills they need at school. The Peace Learning Center offers another kind of workshop on implicit bias, or making stereotypes about groups of people. The PLC offers the Harvard Implicit Bias Test. It is free and available in many different languages. Nation says that after taking the test, students learn to think about and deal with their own biases.
We help them process and reflect on their own biases so they can learn strategies to deal with them.
Jing Lin is a professor of international education policy at the University of Maryland. She teaches classes for educators related to peace and ecological ethics. Lynn says peace education programs can help students a lot. Some students have mental health problems because of conflicts at school or in the community. They need to learn how to deal with that worry and mental pressure.
Students need to know about peace, study about peace, but also to study to have peace with themselves, with the society, and also to study to build peace in our world. So there are great benefits in all levels.
Lynn suggests organizing groups of students into teams by birth month. Then, in these groups, each person tells their life story. This activity and similar ones can help students come to understand that we are all human beings. Peace education is helpful not just for students, Lynn says, and something that everyone needs. I'm Jill Robbins.
Now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Thanksgiving is a holiday in the United States that involves family, friends, fellowship, and food. So today we will talk about some English expressions that deal with food and eating. Let's start with the star of many Thanksgiving meals, the turkey. You could say it's time to talk turkey. When we say that in American English, it means it is time to start talking seriously about a problem and solve it. It does not mean to talk about how dry the cooked turkey is, although that is a common Thanksgiving conversation. Talking turkey is talking direct. For example, let's say some politicians are having a very long meeting about education. They say a lot without really saying anything important. Finally, one of them says, "Look, we need to start talking turkey about our failing schools in the city. They are not going to fix themselves." Now let's move on to a popular side dish, mashed potatoes.
Now, potatoes do not have a strong taste. So, when you make mashed potatoes, it is important to add butter and salt. It is important to butter up those potatoes. But did you know that you can also butter up people? If I butter up my friends, I tell them lots of wonderful things about them. In other words, I flatter them. I give them lots of compliments. However, I don't say these things just to be nice. I want something from them. Back in middle school, I once buttered up my teacher for weeks, hoping to get a better grade. That did not work. It just made him angry. Some people do not like to be flattered or buttered up. The person who you are buttering up might even say, "Don't try to butter me up. Flattery will get you nowhere." Now let's add some salt to those mashed potatoes. But not too much. If you add too much salt, you make a dish unhealthy, and it is likely to taste bad. Sometimes just a pinch is all you need. A grain of salt is even less. That is the smallest piece of salt. If I take something with a pinch of salt or grain of salt, I do not take it too seriously. For example, one of my friends is known for exaggerating and sometimes lying. One day he tells me that he plans to sell all of his belongings, move to New York City, and become a poet. I take this information with a grain of salt. I've heard these kinds of plans from him before, and they never turn out to be true.
While eating Thanksgiving dinner, you must remember to save room for dessert. The sweet food that comes after dinner is a big part of the celebration. For some reason, pie is more common at Thanksgiving than cake. Pumpkin pie is probably one of the most common in America. But apple, cherry, and pecan pie are often served too. In fact, one dinner may have a collection of different pies. So here is an expression related to pie. If something is very, very easy to do, it is easy as pie. In fact, I have made many, many pies. So I could say, making pie is, you guessed it, easy as pie. You can use this idiom for just about anything that is not too serious. When I invite people to my home for Thanksgiving, I make lots of pie. I want to have enough. This way, everyone gets a slice of the pie. When you get a slice of the pie, it is not always something you can eat. This idiom also means that you get part of the money or profits from a shared deal. Before we end, There is one more Thanksgiving expression we need to talk about. Stuffing is a very popular Thanksgiving food. It is a combination of bread, onions, celery, or other vegetables, and herbs. Some people stuff the mixture into the turkey and bake the whole thing together. While many people serve it as a side dish, some families have a stuffed turkey for Thanksgiving. And, like a turkey, we can also feel stuffed after finishing a big Thanksgiving meal and eating too much. Would you like more turkey? More mashed potatoes? No thanks, I'm stuffed. And that's all for this Words in Their Stories Thanksgiving program. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On July 4th, 1863, a huge Confederate army surrendered at Vicksburg, Mississippi. Union forces had surrounded the city for 47 days. Food was gone. The situation was hopeless. The Confederate commander gave up. The terms of surrender were simple. The Confederate soldiers promised not to fight anymore. In return for this promise, they were released on parole and sent home to their families. Never had Union forces won such a victory. 30,000 Confederate soldiers were now out of the war. 60,000 guns and 170 cannon were now in Union hands. The Mississippi River was now under Union control. Larry West and Morris Joyce continue our story of the American Civil War.
The victory at Vicksburg went to General Ulysses Grant. He was named commander of all Union armies in the West. Then he was sent to Chattanooga, Tennessee. The Union army there had just been defeated in a battle along a little river called the Chickamauga. Now the Union soldiers were resting and reorganizing in Chattanooga. The Confederate line stretched halfway around the city. The Confederates had artillery on Lookout Mountain. They controlled every road into the city, except a rough one through the mountains. They had blocked the Tennessee River, above and below the city. And they had cut the railroad. The Confederate general said he would let hunger force the Union Army to surrender.
Grant arrived in Chattanooga late in October. The city was full of hungry Union soldiers. They had been without supplies for almost a month. Grant wasted no time. He quickly sent troops to fight the Confederate force blocking the Tennessee River. He sent others to fight the Confederates blocking the road to the nearest Union supply center. Within 1 week, supply wagons were rolling into Chattanooga. Within a few weeks, the defeated Union army was ready to fight again.
General Grant sent his men against the middle and ends of the Confederate line at the same time. There were few Confederate soldiers at Lookout Mountain. That end of the line fell easily. The center of the line was along a low hill called Missionary Ridge. It held for a while. Then Union soldiers, acting without orders,
forced their way to the top of the hill. The Confederate line broke. Southern soldiers threw down their guns and ran for their lives. The Confederate Army withdrew south into the state of Georgia. Tennessee was completely in Union hands. The way was now open for the armies of the North to march into the heart of the Confederacy.
It was clear that the South could not win the war. Too many Confederate soldiers had fallen in battle. None were left to take their place. Supplies were very low. There was not enough food to eat, no shoes to wear, and little left to fight with. No one held any hope of getting supplies from outside the Confederacy. The South was circled by Union troops and warships. All seemed lost. Yet Confederate soldiers refused to stop fighting. They would not surrender. The war would not end until the Confederate armies were defeated by military force.
There was no question that the North had the military strength. Supplies were no problem. Factories were producing more than ever before. Manpower was no problem. Men continued to join the Union Army. Fewer than before, but still enough to make it a powerful force. The problem with the Union Army was its generals. Some were too careful. Some were unwilling to fight. Some did not know how to fight. The only general who seemed able to win victories was Ulysses Grant. That is why President Abraham Lincoln named Grant commander of all Union armies. Lincoln depended on him to end the Civil War.
Grant went east in March 1864, 5 months after the battle at Chattanooga. He decided to make his headquarters in the field with the Army of the Potomac. He said he would not command from an office in Washington, but he went to the city to explain his plans to President Lincoln. Grant noted that in the past, the separate Union armies had moved and fought independently. He said they were like a poorly trained team of horses. No two of them ever pulled at the same time in the same direction. Under his command, Grant said, the Union armies would pull together. They would hit the Confederates with so much strength in so many places that the rebels could not stop them. Grant said all the armies would attack at the same time.
Grant spent the month of April preparing for the big campaign. The main target, once again, was the Confederate capital at Richmond, Virginia. The Army of the Potomac had 120,000 men. It would move against Richmond from the north. General Ben Butler had 50,000 men. He would move against Richmond from the east. General Franz Sigel would bring thousands more through the Shenandoah Valley to the northwest. These forces were three times the size of Robert E. Lee's army near Richmond. In the west, William Sherman had three armies with more than 100,000 men. His opponent, Joe Johnston, had just 60,000.
General Grant kept details of the campaign as secret as possible. Reporters asked President Lincoln when Grant would move. The president answered, "Ask General Grant." General Grant will not tell us, said the reporters. Said Lincoln, he will not tell me either. The final Union campaign of the Civil War began on May 3, 1864. After 2 days of marching, the Army of the Potomac reached the Wilderness. It was a thickly wooded area west of Fredericksburg, Virginia. That was where the Union Army had lost a battle to the Confederates 1 year before. That was where the two armies would fight again.
The battle quickly became a blind struggle. The woods were thick. The smoke was heavy. The soldiers could not see each other until they were very close. Shells set the trees on fire. The wounded could not escape the flames. Their screams filled the air. After 2 days, General Grant decided that the Wilderness was not the place to fight Robert E. Lee. He wanted to get around the end of Lee's army. He wanted to fight in the open, where he could use his artillery. So, he began to march his men toward a place called Spotsylvania Courthouse.
Lee moved his men as fast as Grant. When the Union Army got to Spotsylvania, the Confederates were waiting behind walls of earth and stone. For several more days, the two armies fought. At times, they were so close they had no time to load and fire their guns. So, they used their guns to hit each other. The Confederate line bent, but it never broke. Once again, Lee had stopped the Union Army. Grant refused to accept defeat. He said he would fight to the finish, if it took all summer. Once again, he ordered his men to march around the end of Lee's line. Lee quickly pulled his men back to a place called Cold Harbor, not far from Richmond. There they waited.
As he had done in the Wilderness and at Spotsylvania, Grant ordered his men to attack hard. It was a slaughter. In less than an hour, 7,000 Union soldiers fell dead or wounded. Grant finally stopped the attack. The Union soldiers returned to their lines. They left behind hundreds of wounded men. For 4 days, the wounded lay on the battlefield crying for help, for water. Men who tried to rescue them were shot down. Finally, Grant and Lee agreed on a ceasefire to take care of the wounded and bury the dead. It was too late for most of the wounded. They had died.
The battle at Cold Harbor ended 1 month of fighting for the Army of the Potomac. The campaign had brought it almost to the edge of Richmond, the Confederate capital. But Grant had paid a terrible price. More than 50,000 dead and wounded. Confederate losses were much lighter, about 20,000. General Grant was beginning to learn an important lesson of the war. The methods of defense had improved much more than the methods of attack.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Ana Mateo.